From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a Palestinian writer who grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon and a best-selling Israeli writer who was born the year Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They're friends. A couple of years ago, they even collaborated on a collection of short stories. First, we'll hear from Edgar Keret, Israel's most famous young writer. His collection of short stories, The Nimrod Flipout, was described as perfectly capturing the craziness of life in Israel. He lives in Tel Aviv, which is within striking distance of Hezbollah missiles. Then we'll hear from Samir El-Yusuf, who managed to get out of the refugee camp and now lives in London, but he has family in Lebanon who have fled from Israeli bombs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's show, we're going to hear from an Israeli writer and a Palestinian writer who grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon. They won't be fighting or debating. They're friends. A couple of years ago, they even collaborated on a book called Gaza Blues. We'll hear from Samir El-Youssef in the second half of the show. First, Edgar Keret, who was described in the New York Times as the most famous young writer in Israel. The author of that article, Nancy Updike, wrote, "Keret's fame is surprising even to himself, since his characters possess none of the qualities on which Israelis usually pride themselves, toughness, decisiveness, and physical courage." Keret has won Israel's Prime Minister's Award for Literature and the Israeli equivalent of an Oscar for a film he helped write and direct. Keret was born in 1967, the same year that Israel occupied the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights. He lives in Tel Aviv and went to a studio there yesterday to record our interview. I asked him about his take on the war.
Well, the strange thing about the war is that both sides are really saying it's very, very temporary. We keep fighting just so we have a better kind of negotiation position the moment that we have to sit to the desk and decide things. So you can't help thinking that, you know, that this war is going to take another couple of weeks or maybe a month. Maybe hundreds or maybe thousands of people will die from both sides just so somebody will feel that he has an upper hand in the negotiation and can get, I don't know, a little bit more. And it gives you that feeling because usually the idea about wars, it doesn't matter what they really are, that you have always this feeling that it's kind of this sense of them being crucial, you know, that you're fighting, you never know when it's going to end, you know, you're fighting just so people won't kill you. And here, this kind of war that is basically, everybody's saying, okay, you know, Hezbollah knows that it won't be destroyed completely, Lebanon knows that it won't be destroyed completely, Israel knows that it won't be conquered. Just a question, you know, will we gain a little bit more by killing somebody who's important in their organization? Will they gain a little bit more by shooting a missile on Tel Aviv? So it's a little bit like kind of a game of chess, you know, in which too many people are dying. So you can't help feeling that you would like things to be decided and right now, you know. Why wait for more people to die?
What is it like for you to watch television and see the amount of destruction that the Israeli forces are carrying out in Lebanon and seeing civilians and children getting, you know, bodies getting carried out of homes that have been destroyed? Like, what impact does that have on you, knowing both that you're under attack by Hezbollah, but at the same time, the Israeli military is responsible for a lot of destruction and death in Lebanon?
It is a horrible feeling, and you know, and you can't help asking yourself, you know, is any of this is necessary, you know? And I said to a friend today that, you know, that in the last few days I heard the Israeli army keep apologizing, you know, for unnecessary attacks, and that I hope that they're better fighters, they are better at fighting than at apologizing, because they're not very good at sincere apologies. You really see that when people talk about this bomb hitting that or the other, they seem to be more concerned about the fact that they won't seem as good air force as they were before, then they're really concerned about the deaths. And you really, and actually when you see the Hezbollah, you know, reacting to those deaths, they react to it as if it's some sort of a victory. You know, those unnecessary deaths seems to them like a good thing happening because it's a good turn for them. Just that, you know, you see bodies of dead children and everybody's kind of trying to explode them to their own needs, you know, and nobody really sees them for what they are. There is something very, very cynical and painful in that.
You live in Tel Aviv, which is within range of some of Hezbollah's missiles. Do you feel vulnerable there?
Look, you know, I felt as vulnerable before the war, knowing that I can have a coffee in a coffee place and the suicide bomber will explode next to me. It's not as if there was a time of quiet around here. Living in this country since I was a child, I always felt vulnerable. You know, it's not, and basically right now, I would say statistically, it's maybe one of the safest times that had passed on Tel Aviv, because there weren't any suicide attacks here. For a long time, the missiles didn't hit us yet. And even if a missile hit us, you know, it doesn't kill more people than a suicide bomber does.
You have a very interesting family. You know, your parents are Holocaust survivors. Your sister is ultra-Orthodox and used to live in a settlement. Your brother was a founder of the Legalized Marijuana Party in Israel. I didn't even know there was such a party. And I'm wondering if you all have similar or conflicting views about the war now.
Well, I think that me and my brother, we feel basically the same. You know, my brother, except for forming the Legalized Marijuana movement, was a very active left-wing activist. You know, my sister's real thing is really different. She's not in any way pro-war. Actually, she doesn't really acknowledge the existence of the State of Israel, basically being extremely ultra-Orthodox. You know, she has a family, she has 11 children, and the way that she perceives things is really that the country of Israel doesn't exist for her, or in any sense, it isn't her country. And all the actions, you know, missiles falling or things that going around has to do with the fact that people aren't being religious and they don't do what they're supposed to do according to the Jewish religion. So you can't really have a political argument with her.
I don't understand why she doesn't see Israel as her country.
Oh, it's easy because, you know, she has a prime minister who doesn't eat kosher, you know. There are people here who decide things in a democratic way. She doesn't believe in the way of democracy. She really believes in the way of the Bible. And actually, I must say that through my sister that I love a lot and I learned a lot from, I really understood a lot of things about our struggle with the Hamas and the Hezbollah, because many people like to see those struggles as national struggles, but it's actually kind of, it's a religious war. And when it's a war of religion and not war of nations, all the laws are different. The narratives are different. The ontology is different. The way that people fight against you is different. And I think that many times, especially in the Western world, when we talk about people who are a religious fundamentalist, we like to kind of colonialize their thought and think that they have the same values that we have, and that if they do anything, they would do it according to our psychology. For example, that if somebody does a suicide bombing, he has to be depressed or in a bad situation. But, you know, speaking to my sister or other people who are extremely religious, death really is seen in another way. It doesn't necessarily seen as a bad thing, you know. So basically, if you're a religious fundamentalist and you blow up somewhere, you could be in a very, very good mood, you know, having a very wonderful life. But actually, because you serve a purpose, you want to forward that purpose, and you see yourself as a small molecule in a bigger picture. So basically, you know, I can connect with her on an emotional level, but I understand that the way that she thinks and the way that she sees life is fundamentally different than the way that I do.
So it's interesting, your sister, who is a Jewish ultra-Orthodox believer, has helped you understand Hezbollah.
Yes. It helped me understand that really that my intuition as somebody who lives in a democracy and holds a set of values. So this intuition of mine that what I see as the universal truths aren't necessarily universal truths. People can strive for many things. You know, for example, I always thought that people want democracy, that any society would strive for democracy. But actually, my sister doesn't live in a democratic society in her neighborhood. She lives in a theocratic society, and she thinks it's much better than democracy. She really thinks that democracy is not such a great idea. She really thinks that democracy leads to some sort of a wild and violent individualism that ruins the idea of a community. She really thinks that people really, it's not about what many people think, it's about what the people that count thinks. For example, for her, it's a rabbi. So all those things that I really always thought that everybody thinks like me, I really understand that there are some people who think in another way.
My guest is the Israeli writer Edgar Keret. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is the Israeli writer Edgar Keret, and he's joining us from Tel Aviv. Now, the best-known Israeli writers, outside of yourself, have been pretty political in writing about Israel and reflecting on Israel's life, you know, the life of the country, the conflicts the country's been in. And your writing is almost famous for not being political, for being on a smaller scale and more about certain absurdities and paradoxes of life. And I'm wondering if it's difficult to remain an almost apolitical writer in Israel.
Well, I see myself as a very political writer. It's just that my politics is different. I think that in Israel, when people talk about politics, they talk about something very reductive. They really talk about some sort of simplification of a situation. Politics a priori means that if you're political, you don't contain any sort of ambiguities. You know, like being political, it's kind of a package deal. It's kind of a pragmatic route. It means that I support this party and I don't support that party. And I really think that politics should be something much more complex than that. And being a fiction writer, when I write about life, I want to show them as complex and as ambiguous and as paradoxical as they are. And when I write about the situation, I really want to write about the ambiguities. Because to say this guy is right and the other guy is right doesn't seem political for me. It just seems simplifying and boring.
Now, you've had a friendship and a collaborative relationship with a Palestinian writer named Samir El-Yousef, who grew up in a refugee camp in southern Lebanon. And you collaborated on a book together called Gaza Blues. He's our other guest on today's show. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship you have together and how you got together?
Well, basically, Samir and me, I think each of us is kind of different among the landscape of the writers. Like, he's not a typical Palestinian writer, and I'm not a typical Israeli writer. I think that, let's say, when you talk about politics, many Israeli writers are not happy with my politics. And this doesn't mean that they think, you know, I'm too left-wing or anything. They just say, you know, he's not clear enough. He's not talking about the topics that he's supposed to talk about. He's not talking about them the way he's supposed to, you know. He doesn't have the pathos necessary to talk about those subjects. And I think that Samir suffers from the same problem. So it's actually, you know, when we met, it was like a two people's support group. It was kind of like an AA meeting, you know, and the fact that we could have a dialogue, you know, and disagree about things, but still survive it because we really believe that there are some things that are more important than let's say what you specifically think about an issue, and that's how do you conduct a dialogue? Can you be critical of yourself in some situation without this being kind of interpreted as a weakness in the eyes of the enemy?
That's you know, it, yeah.
And the fact that both Samir and me, when we talk about an issue, we just say what we feel made us different.
Now, you were supposed to be on a panel with a couple of Palestinian writers. I think it was in Sweden, maybe. And they refused to appear on stage with you because you're Israeli. They would talk with you in private, but they wouldn't talk with you on stage. And I'm wondering what your reaction was to that.
Well, it was in Norway.
It was in Norway. Okay.
It was in Norway, and actually, one of the people who refused to be with me on stage, his name is Izzat El Ghazawi. He died since then, but before dying, he translated one of my story collection to Arabic and published it in the Palestinian Authority. I think it was maybe the only fiction book that was published in the Palestinian Authority since the beginning of the Second Intifada. And it really showed this kind of a contradiction between the fact that he was curious and interested in what Israelis are doing, but at the same time felt that he couldn't officially sit with them on stage. When he said to me, he said, "I hope that you accept it and understand it." So I said to him, "Listen, I accept it, but I really don't understand it." And at the same writers' meeting, the late Jacques Derrida was there, and he actually attacked the Palestinian writers from stage, and he said to them, "If you don't want to sit with a left-wing fiction writer from Israel, who do you want to sit with? Do you want to sit with Ariel Sharon? Do you want to sit with the Israeli right wing? Or just you'd settle for sitting with Norwegian people? Do you want to make a peace with Norway? There is something about this kind of basic statement that I really don't see any progress coming from such declarations.
So the same writer who refused to share a stage with you published your book in Gaza and the West Bank.
It was in Ramallah, actually.
In Ramallah, but his position remained the same.
He really felt that it was important for Palestinians to read my fiction because he thought that it would give them a different image of Israel than they had before that. And we had a very funny dialogue about it because when the book came out, I had an email from the publisher, and after that my agent talked to the publisher, and the publisher said, listen, the book... It says really well. We finished the first edition, but we aren't exactly sure if there are many people reading it or if the Hamas bought all the copies and burned them. we still didn't make up our mind. And another Palestinian friend of mine told me that the collection of stories was called The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God. And he said that he met one of his students, and the student was very, very disappointed because he thought it was a collection of stories about a shahid who explodes himself in a bus because it was the bus driver who wanted to be God. He said, bus driver, God, there must be kind of suicide bombing somewhere. And when he bought it and he saw it was just kind of about a story about an egomaniac bus driver, he was very, very disappointed. I think that you kind of developed this kind of macabre sense of humor. And, you know, and that's what Samir and me have. And I feel that there is something very good about this kind of route of communication that is completely not PC, and that it's completely kind of feels okay to talk about things and to laugh about things that you usually don't laugh about it. Because when you do it, it's actually proof that you can overcome this sense of rigidness, you know, because sitting with somebody on stage or just kind of exchanging predictable slogans, it doesn't get you any closer anywhere. But being able to sit with somebody in a room and, you know, and to crack a joke about something that you wouldn't think that you'd be cracking jokes with him about is some sort of a development because it's a normalcy.
Your parents were Holocaust survivors, so growing up you knew that they had survived something very terrible. I don't know how much they actually told you about it, but I'm sure you could guess that it was really horrible. And then, of course, growing up in Israel, Israel has been part of several wars since you were born. Did you grow up afraid of war and afraid of anti-Semitism and afraid that someday maybe you'd have to face something like what your parents faced in the Holocaust? Or did you grow up without that kind of shadow of fear?
No, I grew up very fearful and very hysterical. You know,
hysterical, do you say?
Yeah, I think that one thing that I always felt is that the existence of Israel as a country and the existence of Jews as people is not something that is trivial. The idea of genocide was always somewhere in the air, and I'm not saying that it's necessarily justified, but the fact that my wife always says, you don't live, you survive. In that sense that, you know, that there always, I think, this kind of burden, or there is this feeling of struggle or potential struggle, not necessarily a violent one, but it's very difficult for me just to be laid back or relaxed because I always kind of have all those kind of worst-case scenarios going in my head.
You have a son now, right? How old is your child?
7 months.
7 months, very young. When times get dangerous like this, do you consider leaving Israel for your son's sake so that he isn't growing up exposed to the same kind of fears and exposed to the kind of wars?
Well, you know, he's a tough kid. You know, when things get tough, I think in a few months' time we'll start hiding behind him because he's really tough. He's a really tough kid. One thing that my parents always told me is that the fact is that Israel, I may not like things or many things that are happening here, but when I argue about them, nobody can say to me, you know, if you're not happy, just take your things and leave. You know, I'm part of it. And one of the ideas that I got from my parents being Holocaust survivors is that when you're an immigrant, you never have this kind of a strong moral hold in the place that you live in. And I think that, you know, I'm unhappy with many things happening in Israel, but at least here I believe that maybe I have a way of affecting them and changing them, and I have the legitimation to do it. And I don't know if I'll feel the same in another place. And another thing, you know, I'm a writer. I live inside language. I love the Hebrew language. And I love many things in the country that I live in, so it will be very, very difficult decision, almost impossible for me to immigrate. And, you know, and again, you know, when I was born, things didn't look any better than they look now. And I grew up, and I feel that there's always a fear, and there is always a pessimism, at least in my family. But I hope that, you know, that when they were really scared when I was born, you know, about the future of the country, they were wrong. And I hope that I'm wrong too.
Well, Edgar Carrot, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Edgar Carrot spoke to us from a studio in Tel Aviv. He co-authored the book Gaza Blues with the Palestinian writer Samir El-Youssef, who we'll hear from in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Sailing from Byzantium, How a Lost Empire Shaped the World, an account of the Byzantine Empire and its ongoing legacy by Colin Wells. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Samir El-Youssef tells us about growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. He was exposed to a lot of radical rhetoric about martyrdom, but what he responded to was literature. Now he's a writer living in London, but he has relatives in Lebanon who have had to flee from the Israeli bombing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Samir El-Youssef, was born in 1965 in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. He was exposed to a lot of radical rhetoric about martyrdom, but what he responded to was literature. He's now a writer living in London. Last year, the Swedish chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization, awarded him the Tucholsky Award, which is for writers who are persecuted or living in exile. In 2004, he co-authored the short story collection Gaza Blues with the Israeli writer Edgar Carrot, who we just heard from. El-Youssef's mother lives in Lebanon, and some of his relatives there have had to flee from Israeli bombing. I spoke with him yesterday and asked him first about his view of the war.
What this war actually reminds me is it reminds me of 1994, just after the Oslo Agreement, in which the Hamas and the al-Jihad in Gaza and the West Bank vowed to sort of bury the peace process, as they said at the time. And basically that's what they went about to do by basically sort of launching a campaign of suicide bombing against Israel. The thing is, Israel, in its you know, usual reaction of being an overreaction, an excessive reaction, somehow accommodated the Hamas people by sort of, you know, responding to their desire to destroy the peace process, which more or less what happened in the years that followed. What we see here is somehow similar. We have a country that's trying to rebuild itself, Lebanon, with its different confessions and groups who are trying to live with each other peacefully, or with some, you know, with a degree of peace, in which no group or no confession can sort of impose its own will on the other groups. Shiite, Sunni, Christian, Maronite, Orthodox, etc. And there it is, Hezbollah, who believes in violence, who believes in the continuation state of war, targets Israel in this manner, and Israel responds by sort of accommodating its desire to create a state of war and state of violence in Lebanon. Unfortunately, we have basically, you know, people like Hamas and Hezbollah and al-Jihad, groups who do not believe in peace, groups who have an agenda for war and violence. They are very coherent, very, in a sense, brutally honest about it. They've never said anything otherwise. On the other hand, we have Israel, who is always willing to sort of accommodate these people and responding to their desires. Somehow I feel like, you know, there's a, you know, it's just as if rebuilding, living in peace is just sort of, you know, is something that's, it's not going to happen, not only because of one group that doesn't want. It's like just on both sides, there are sort of a certain desire or willingness to destroy any attempt to rebuild and to live in peace.
Now, you grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon, and so you came of age with a lot of militant Palestinians, and I'm wondering what the rhetoric was like when you were a teenager.
Well, the public was, you know, lots of sloganization, lots of slogans and mottos about liberating our country, about the resistance, about our right to return, about fighting imperialism and fighting Zionism and fighting this and fighting that. This was a sort of, you know, overwhelming rhetoric within the camp and within Lebanon in general in the 70s, wherever there was sort of, you know, a PLO influence or the left-wing Lebanese political parties. This was a kind of rhetoric that was dominant. For me and for other writers, especially for my generation, we had to fight our way through in order to sort of not to succumb to this kind of hollow rhetoric of sloganization, of resistance and fighting, you know, imperialism and fighting this and fighting that. The great help was, of course, from literature, from international writings, but also from private experiences, from the sort of, you know, popular way of expressing themselves, of how folks, how ordinary people, talk about things. And that was very helpful in this attempt to find a different language from the rather sort of, you know, rhetorical, political language that was dominant at the time.
In your novella, The Day the Beast Got Thirsty, you have a character named Ahmed, who is a militant within the Palestinian refugee camp. And the main character says, "I liked listening to Ahmed, especially after I had a couple of joints. But sometimes Ahmed used to say things that made me realize that unless I leave the country, I shall go mad." What kind of things did you hear that made you feel like you would go mad?
Well, I think he goes on. I think the character of the novella goes on to say that, you know, Ahmed at one time tells him, like, you know, they're going to be a war. You know, after that war, everything will be all right. So he tells him, for how long this war going to go on? He tells him, well, it's about 20, 30 years. So, I mean, you know, that's what would drive you mad. If somebody tells you that we're going to have peace, but only first we're going to have a long war of 20 or 30 years, I don't think you want to hang around waiting for that war to end. The reference to madness basically is the idea that the absurdity of the situation in the Lebanon, especially at the time that the novella takes place, which is towards the end of the 80s. And a great deal of the expressions, they don't mean what they say. You know, the narrator starts with this sentence, I like listening to Ahmed, and it goes on and on all through the novella. But, you know, by the end of it, you don't know whether he really likes to listen to Ahmed or not. It's just somebody saying something that's to express, you know how bad things are, because what Ahmed says is just basically makes him, you know, angry, makes him laugh, you know, it's just a sort of thing that, you know, you don't want really to hear in a sense.
Let me quote something that gives a sense of the ironic tone of your novel. And this is the main character thinking ironically, "Yes," I thought to myself, "we must get married, Dalal and I. We will get married and have 10 children. But then they will die and have their photos as huge posters glued to the walls of the camp, declaring them as heroic martyrs who have died while fighting the Zionist enemy. And Dalal and I would be the proudest parents of 10 martyrs. After that, Israel could invade Lebanon again, destroy our camp, mess us all up, so we die and get the hell out of this life." And I just say, I took a couple of liberties, changing a couple of the of the words, yes, that we can't say on the radio. So did you have friends who wanted their children to grow up to be martyrs?
Certainly not. I can't recall anybody. I don't remember anybody who wanted his children to be martyrs, or they wanted to be martyrs. Not at all. Especially at that time of the of our lives, I don't think anybody believed in martyrdom. In the contrary, I mean, the whole point of this passage, this expression, is to make fun of the whole idea of martyrdom, you know, that the children are going to be killed by whatever it is, you know. I mean, at one point in the novella, there is a sort of a dispute, a fight, a battle between local militias and local parties. And the people who are killed in this battle are called martyrs. So it's in a sense to show the hollowness of this expression of martyrdom, of how easy, of how simple to consider anybody who died, you know, in any kind of absurd fight or clash between local militias, to consider him as a martyr. One of the reasons of writing about it in this manner is actually to sort of, you know, to expose this kind of rhetoric for what it is. You know, this idea about the heroic martyrs who are fighting the Zionist enemy, when they are not fighting the Zionist enemy, and they are not heroic, and they certainly are not martyrs. But it's just sort of to just take this concept and show it how hollow it is and how meaningless it is, and strip it from all the sort of, you know, from all the ideology that supports it and glorify it.
As a Palestinian refugee in Lebanon, did you have the rights of a citizen in Lebanon?
No, certainly not. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been a refugee. Well, I mean, part of the problem of refugee is not only what is the war of 1948. You're going to find a lot of people who are just going to talk about Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and in Jordan and Syria. And there are a lot of them, they demand the right to return and things like that. There is an attempt to use this issue. I mean, there is an issue. There is a problem on the ground, basically. It's called the refugee problems, and it is in Lebanon, it's in Jordan, it's in Syria, where a huge number of Palestinians are still living in refugee camps without any political or civil rights, great deal of them. I mean, in a country like Lebanon, there are dozens and dozens of jobs that Palestinians are not allowed to practice. Palestinians are not allowed to benefit from any kind of the public sector. They are not allowed to be employed by the public sector, by the Lebanese public sector. They are not allowed to go to schools or hospitals in Lebanon. So this is after 60 years of living there. So it's a problem that has, you know, there's more than one, you know, responsible party for it. Basically starts with Israel, but then it goes on to include the Lebanese government, the Jordanian government, the Arab countries in general, who are not sort of, you know, helping to solve this problem. And of course, the PLO, who for a long time used the refugee camps in order to promote their own kind of politics.
What year did you leave Lebanon?
I left Lebanon at the end of 1989. I left and went to Cyprus and stayed for a year there and worked there. And then having acquired residence permit in Cyprus, I was lucky enough to get a visa to come to England.
Which is where you live now.
Yes.
My guest is Samir El Youssef. He's a writer who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is essayist and fiction writer Samir El-Youssef. He grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon and now lives in London. How are you exposed to literature?
It's strange. I grew up in a house which where there were no books whatsoever apart from the Quran which was not read because my parents are illiterate, or my father and my mother didn't read. And by and large, people around me didn't read. People only read books that were meant to be read at, you know, at school and for education. I don't know. It was part of this yearning for something else, I suppose. It was this desire. I've always had this imagination, the sense that there is something beyond, something greater, something bigger and larger and more complicated and richer than the one we had. And I suppose I came about with to books through this sort of, you know, this yearning, this imagination that led me to feel that there must be something else. And books, I suppose, like films, like photos, like so many things that sort of were one way of trying to sort of, you know, satisfy this yearning for the world that lies beyond.
What were some of the books that made the biggest impression on you?
Well, I mean, basically the Egyptian writer Najib Mahfouz was one of the greatest influence. You know, in his style, the way he constructs his narrative, the tales that he tells, the world of Cairo in the 30s and the 40s, somehow. And within the Arab world, Cairo was a sort of different place, a richer place, a greater place, more complicated. So many things. There is poverty, but there's certain charm to this kind of poverty. This is a sort of a poverty of a more traditional setting. You know, that somebody who lives in a refugee camp can identify with. I mean, you know, unlike the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which was very luxurious, very sort of. Push in a sense, it was very hard. You could, with Beirut, you feel there is really a difference. There is a huge gap between you and Beirut, but with Cairo was something else for somebody who lived in a refugee camp.
Growing up in Lebanon during the civil war and the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, and growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp where I imagine there was a lot of just petty crime too, as there is in a lot of poor neighborhoods. Did you grow up with a sense of constant fear, or were you just so used to it that didn't even get to you?
The fear and danger came from politics more than anything else, not from the social life there. I mean, this is one of the amazing things about lives, the time I'm describing or I'm talking about, that is the early 70s, the late 60s and early 70s. One thing about Palestinian refugees in the camps, they sort of behaved themselves. You would hardly hear about any kind of incident. I mean, there were sort of trouble between families, some kind of feud, some old feuds and conflicts of this sort. But like, you know, theft, murder, I mean, all these sort of things, it wasn't something common. I mean, it's so rare. I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's not because there was a good police or good policing or good belief in law and order. It's just there was this sort of, you know, Palestinians managed after all these years, after they left their communities back in Palestine and transferred it to Lebanon. They lived within the moral code of a traditional society, where you just sort of, there are families where people respect, where the young respect the old, and people respect their borders and everything. So it was a kind of, they managed to sort of, you know, maintain this sort of life. The only danger really that we were worried about, it was the one came from the conflict, the clashes between the PLO and Israel.
When you meet Palestinians who grew up in the Gaza or the West Bank, and you compare experiences, what are some of the most similar and different things about your experience and theirs?
What I notice usually is the difference rather than the similarities. I mean, for people who lived in the, you know, in the occupied territories, especially particularly refugees in Gaza and the West Bank, the only people, you know, the only sort of aggressive or dominant force, you know, is Israelis. For us in Lebanon, it was more than just the Israelis. The Israelis were the Israelis, the Syrians, Lebanese, sometimes the Palestinians themselves, the PLO, for example. So it's always sort of, you know, a sense of there's something different. I mean, you know, we assume that we are alike, but then once we start sort of dealing with our problems, expressing our concerns, expressing our political views and ideas, you realize that there are quite a few differences between both of us, between people in the West Bank and Gaza and Lebanon.
No, I'm wondering if that helped shape your attitude toward the Israelis, in the sense that the Israelis weren't the only group that you might see as your enemy, because there were other people who were a danger to Palestinian refugees. There were other groups.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think you mentioned 1982. I wasn't really that much frightened. I mean, I know that the Israelis went for full-scale war against the PLO in Lebanon, and quite a few thousand people were arrested and imprisoned in southern South Lebanon. I don't think I was at any time as frightened as later on when the war of the camps, for example, with a sort of Lebanese militia attacking Palestinians. I was more frightened then than from the Israelis. I'm not saying that the Israelis were very nice and friendly. They were not. But what I'm saying that they were, in a sense, you felt less in danger than you with the militia, with a sort of Lebanese militia that who were acting out of sheer hatred sometimes. So it was that, and you are absolutely right. This awareness, I mean, for me, if you would have asked me at that time if you're going to be arrested or captured by anybody, by the Israelis or the Syrians or the Lebanese militia, which one would you want to be arrested with? I would say the Israelis right away. I would know what would happen to me with the Israelis. I'm not sure that I know what would happen to me with the Syrians or with the Lebanese militias. I'm not saying this to praise the Israelis, but I'm to say how bad things were and why, in a sense, I grew up to believe that we are not just facing, it's not a question of two sides fighting one another. We are more than one side. There are more than two sides. There are plenty of sides there, and everybody's fighting everybody. And the idea for peace and the whole project of peace, it must address all these issues, all these sides, not to just say it's just a question of Arabs against Israelis or Palestinians against Israelis. There is more to it than just that. And there are certain times in which, you know, an Arab side might be more dangerous to another Arab side than the Israelis. And it in more than one occasion it happened that way.
Yeah, well, I can't help but wonder how growing up in an atmosphere with a lot of hate, because it was a civil war, it was a period of occupation, and the way you're describing it, a lot of different groups preyed on Palestinians. How do you grow up in a climate of hate and distrust like that and emerge without being a hater yourself?
I don't know. I just think that I think that there is a human will. There is the human will plays a great deal of it. I mean, and in a sense of awareness of more than one of existing of more than one side to it, of more than one dimension of more. I mean, the sense that, you know, Jews are not sort of aliens coming from another planet, some kind of sinister aliens coming from another planet. The awareness that there's life, that there's society there, that there are people, that there are parents, that they are professionals, that people grow up, wake up in the morning because they're thinking about their social problems, about how to earn money. It's not, they're not thinking about going and killing Palestinians. They're thinking about, you know, surviving, you know, in their daily lives. But it does help a great deal to sort of realize, starting from yourself, what is worrying you. I mean, you know, at an early age, I realized it is not destroying the Israelis or killing the Israelis is what really concerns us most. It's what concerns us, how to get out of this awful life in the refugee camp, how to get education and to get out of it and have a sort of peaceful life somewhere else. That's what we are worried about, not fighting somebody, fighting the enemy, as the public and nationalist rhetoric went around. So it's this kind, if you reflect on that, if you sort of reflect on what's been happening, it wouldn't be very hard to sort of, you know, overcome the sentiment of hate. And by and large, I grew up within an environment which did not appreciate the whole idea of this sentiment of hatred. I don't think in my surrounding there been ever somebody who really hated the Israeli, like hate, that I really wish them harm. There was a sense that they are basically our enemies, but it's sort of, it wasn't hate. It was like, you know, all right, we had a fight with them. They are our enemies. We're still at war with them. And basically it's too long a conflict to keep hating. It's just, you can't keep hating.
My guest is Samir El-Youssef. He's a writer who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is essayist and fiction writer Samir El-Youssef. He grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon and now lives in London. Do you expect to see a Palestinian state in your lifetime?
No.
Really?
No, I don't think so. Oh, well, I mean, at best it's going to be a failed Palestinian state.
Why a failed state?
Well, can't you see? Can't you see what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank and the West Bank? So I don't think it's going to be a peaceful Palestinian state.
Do you feel like you've found a real home in London?
No, I can't say that. I mean, London is very comfortable. London has been very generous for me and for people like me. It's a great place to be. It's great. I've been really very lucky to live the last 15 or 16 years of my life in London. I've learned so much. It's been really a great thing to be in London in all this time and to benefit from it in terms of education, friendship and knowledge. It's great. It's a great place, but I can't call it home.
What do you call home?
I don't really know. I don't know what home is, to be honest. I was born in a refugee camp. Once you are born in a refugee camp, you don't know the meaning of the word home. So I would call myself, being too pretentious here, sort of, you know, metaphysical homeless, I suppose, or something like that.
Metaphysically homeless?
Yeah. I mean, basically, I do not have idea what a home is supposed to mean. I mean, you know, I very much cherish a saying by the German Jewish philosopher Theodor Adorno, who says the highest form of morality is not to feel at home even when you are at home.
Just one last thing. It seems to me that your sense of wanting a peaceful resolution to the Palestinian refugees and to the Middle East wars is somehow connected to your love of literature. I'm not saying that your love of literature led to your interest in peace, but they're both connected to the same impulse, which has to do with having a sense of empathy for other people and seeing, being able to stand back and seeing a kind of larger picture.
Yes, of course. I mean, I don't read literature in order to sort of, you know, just read the political message or any other message in it. Literature is art. I remember reading a novel by an Israeli writer. I think it was Aharon Appelfeld, the Israeli writer, and it was about a novel about three Jewish boys who are wandering across Europe during the Nazi assault in Eastern Europe, in Poland, other places, and they are just running from one place to a place, and they are being, you know, and you feel it like at any time these boys will be arrested and by the Nazis and being sent to Auschwitz or any of the concentration camps, and by the end of it, these boys managed to get on a ship that was going to Palestine. And I remember when I read it, I read the ending, I felt a sense of relief that that what happened at the end. But then for one second I realized these people are coming to my country. They are coming to take my country. It was coming to Palestine in the 40s. And that was literature is all about, isn't it? It's, I mean, literature is about this sense of something that changes you, changes your attitude. You discover your humanity. You know, suddenly something larger than a country, larger than a home, larger than the whole idea of national identity. And that to identify with three children, which I could see myself as one of them, you know, wandering in a sort of in a hostile environment, in a hostile country, where just one mistake will lead to your death, and suddenly just wandering and trying to find a place to where they can be safe. And this sense, this comes through reading fiction. This comes through reading a novel. I mean, I've argued against, you know, Jewish immigration to Palestine for ages, and suddenly, all of a sudden, I suddenly realized that, you know, how important for people to come to Palestine, for important for them. Later on, of course, my attitude developed in different ways. But I'm saying that how important for a novel to sort of open up our minds and our sentiments to other people's existence, other people's experience. And yes, that's what helped me to sort of understand and to be aware and to have sense of the Jewish experience in Europe in the first half of the 20th century.
Well, I regret that our time is up. Samir El-Youssef, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Samir El-Youssef co-authored the book Gaza Blues with the Israeli writer Edgar Keret. His essays and reviews have been published in English and Arabic newspapers. He spoke to us from London. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Robin Williams. He's starring in the new movie The Night Listener, based on an Armistead Maupin novel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.